Okay, I think we might get started if you don't mind. Welcome to the first literature and creative writing research seminar of the term. It is fantastic to see so many people here. I'm Veronica Alfano, and I just want to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the Macquarie University land, the Wallamattagal clan of the Darug Nation, whose cultures and customs have nurtured and continue to nurture this land since the Dreamtime, and we pay our respects to elders past and present. And I'm going to introduce our speaker now. Xianming Bai received his master's degree in literature and society, Enlightenment, Romantic, and Victorian from the University of Edinburgh in 2018. And he's now studying a co-tutel PhD program in English at Fudan University in Shanghai, China, and also here at Macquarie. And he is the Chinese translator of Lucasta Miller's book, The Bronte Myth, which was published in 2023, and he also writes for Guangming Daily in China. And today he's talking about Jane Eyre in China, a transnational transfer and cross-cultural spread. So yeah, over to you, and excited to hear your talk.
Thank you, Veronica, for first inviting me to this event. My name is Xianming Bai, and I thought this would be a very great gesture to start my presentation here, because as you will see in many Chinese Kung Fu movies, this is a gesture to welcome your audience for being here. Today, the title of my talk would be Jane Eyre in China, 1867 to 1949, Transnational Transfer and Cross-Cultural Spread. This was actually a presentation derived from a published article. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with this.
Just the arrow.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. It was a paper published in Bronte Studies early April this year. So if you're interested in this paper, you may just simply click the link, and that would direct you to my paper. Although there has been a growing scholarly interest in the Bronte studies in China since its reform and opening up, which we called Gaige Kaifang, in the late 1970s, the Bronte sisters' initial entry to China, the translation of their works, and the Chinese reception before 1949 have not been adequately mapped out. So basically, here is the research gap, because when people talk about foreign literature introduced to China, you may think about the Cultural Revolution, which is a 10-year time period from 1966 to 1976, when everything foreign was forbidden, was banned from public view in China. So it's only natural to think about the reception of Brontes in China happened after 1979, when China started to reform and open up to the world. But that is actually not true. So my presentation first delved into the transnational journey of the Brontes to China in Shanghai-based English newspapers. It then examines how the intellectual debate over literary translation in the 1920s preconditions the quintessentially Chinese reception of Jane Eyre, and is a cinematic reconstruction in the coming decades, centered on whether they were of political relevance to China. And also, I attend a ways in which the controversial Chinese reception of Jane Eyre's 1944 Hollywood film adaptation unveils a society that was drastically transforming itself on the intellectual, socio-political, and the military fronts. That's it. And also, the structure of my presentation will be in four parts. The first part talk about the Brontes in Shanghai-based English newspapers from 1867 to 1946. And then it moved to the intellectual debate over literary translation during the New Culture Movement, the introductions of the Bronte sisters, the translation of Jane Eyre and its early reception, and then finally I talk about the reception of Jane Eyre's movie adaptation after the Second Sino-Japanese War. For those of you who notice, the first one, the time period of the first section is actually overlapping with the later one, because you may understand the first one as English as media, in what I call the transnational transfer, because transnational transfer, I mean by transnational transfer, it refers to the kind of you know, the introduction of the Bronte sister from England to China with English still as the media, without any appearance of the Chinese language in the introduction. And from the second, third, and the fourth part, you will notice that Chinese language and Chinese translators play a very important part, okay? For the first one, about the Brontes in Shanghai-based English language newspaper, 1867 to 1946. First, I want to delve into some basic context. Obviously, that was the time period when China was transforming from the Qing Dynasty to Republican China. Qing Dynasty is the last dynastic rule over China from 1600 to 1900. And also you will come across two opium wars, which is basically two wars between, the first one is the war between Qing Dynasty and the Britain. The second is between Qing Dynasty and the Anglo-French military forces. The whole idea of the two opium wars is to force the Qing Dynasty to open trade with foreign countries, obviously about opium, and also many Chinese tea, silver, China. Because before the two opium wars, Guangzhou in Guangdong province is the only city that can open trade with the UK and foreign you know, businessmen. But after the two opium wars, China started to open trade in Shanghai, in Nanjing, and also China land, so-called land, Hong Kong to United Kingdom. When it comes to translation of Jenna, you will notice that it takes a rather belated gesture when compared with Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels, and maybe seven novels of Charles Dickens. But its appearance in China happened actually before that in English language newspapers. Treaties like that of Nanjing, which concluded two opium wars, provided judicial guarantees for the boost of missionary work and outpouring of English newspapers in Shanghai. On the other side of my slide, there's the Treaty of Nanjing, which is currently on show in the British Museum. And also, this is also from the exhibition, which is currently at the British Museum. The signing of the unequal Treaty of Nanjing led to more ports being forcibly open to foreign trade. So that is where I managed to find the first appearance of Bronte-related articles. The North China Daily News, a daily edition of the weekly North China Herald, which is a British-run newspaper basically headquartered in Shanghai. And this is a building of the North China Daily News, which I managed to find here. It is now still in use, houses the American International Assurance. And it was reported in this newspaper that English nationals in Shanghai was promised a visitation of three bishops, like those readers of one of Bronte's novels. And this novel clearly refers to Charlotte Bronte's Shirley. Although this reference to Shirley is a very isolated instance and does not really refer to the subject of my presentation, Jeanette, it still merits mention because it assumes considerable familiarity with Charlotte Bronte's work among the paper's English readers. And from 1914 onwards, I managed to find 70 issues of North China Daily News, which covered the multifarious combinations of topics pertaining to the Brontes, from the last portrait of Charlotte Bronte, from the authorship over Wuthering Heights, because it is rumored that Wuthering Heights was actually written by Patrick Bronte and maybe Branwell Bronte. This is very interesting because I also managed to find the obituary of Augustin Birrell, who is a very famous British government officer who held different positions across the United Kingdom. And he was remembered, as the title of the newsletter put it, for essays and the Bronte life. And this Bronte life refers to the biography he wrote for Charlotte Bronte. A statesman is not remembered for his service to the government, but for writing a biography for Charlotte Bronte. Still speaks the, you know, the kind of the mass assimilation of Charlotte Bronte's in this kind of newspapers. Why this is important? Because you may wonder, after all, this information, these papers were circulated in English language newspapers. It is because there is likely to be, you know, cross-fertilization between the English readers and the Chinese communities in Shanghai. Because I also managed to find a kind of, this is what we call in Chinese, 图书馆新天书籍表, means a list of newly arrived books to the library. And this library refers to the Shanghai Municipal Council Public Library. And from the very first line, which is from your right-hand side, you can see Charlotte Bronte by E.F. Benson. This was a book published in 1932. It was transported to this public library in Shanghai for Chinese readers in the following year in such a timely fashion, speaks that are, you know, kind of possible cross-fertilization between two language communities, okay? Part two is about, here is about how Chinese language has played a part in the transplantation or the spread of the Brontes to Chinese audiences. It's about the intellectual debate over literary translation during the New Culture Movement. Because here, you will also encounter some of the contexts, because the Lei Qing Dynasty ended in the year 1911 because of what we call the Xinhai Revolution or 1911 Revolution in the English-speaking world. And the subsequent founding of Republic of China, which is a little bit different from you know the currently what we call the People's Republic of China, which is the nowadays government. And before that, Chinese people think about the translation of scientific undertakings, philosophical undertakings, such as, for example, Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, Huxley, and also Darwinian theory concerning the evolutions of species to be of paramount importance. But after the 1915 political fiasco of restoring hereditary monarchy in China initiated by Yuan Shikai, there's a kind of well-conceived idea about the importance of, you know, democracy and the science together in the minds of Chinese intellectuals, because they used to think science plays a much more important role. They later find out that maybe democracy is what we currently and urgently needed. So that is how the translation of literature plays a very important role, because literature constitutes a very large, very important part in the very general idea of humanities. And these two pictures of Yuan Shikai, before and after his coronation. In the 1920s and 30s, even in the late, maybe in the late first decade of the 20th century, leading Chinese scholars were debating very actively about the importance of literary translation in China. These are some of the masterminds of Chinese Enlightenment movement. The Chinese intelligentsia were actively involved in debating the categorization of literary works to be translated in a descending order of urgency. This is really interesting because Zhou Zuoren wrote to Shen Yanbing, who is better known for his pen name Mao Dun. He wrote about, you know, the importance of translation and literature, but he defined literature, Western literature, to be translated into two categories. He even joked with Mao Dun, saying that you, such a talented man, it would be such a pity for you to translate Paradise Lost into Chinese. But Zhou Zuoren himself translated Greek mythology into Chinese. Why he said it would be a pity for Mao Dun to translate, Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost is because I think they are discussing about what is more urgently needed for the Chinese politics. When Chinese people are suffering under the regime of different warlords after Yuan Shikai's restoration of monarchy failed. So Chinese people are suffering and there's no time for scholarly research which are related to, for example, Paradise Lost. So he says something about we have to translate what he called master reads that mainly consists of literary works of modern times. The problem with this correspondence is they actually didn't really define what they mean by master reads of modern times. But if we, however, take Goethe's Faust as the most recent work cherry-picked by Zhou Zuoren in his first category of literature, which he called classic, that merits Chinese translation that Charlotte Brontë's Jane Eyre published 40 years later than Faust, probably fits into the second category, modern master reads. And very interesting about Mao Dun having Jane Eyre in his mind is that I recently find, which is not included in my presentation in my paper, is that he personally translated 3 to 4 chapters of Jane Eyre. It is now in the very good hands of Shanghai Museum, but I don't think Chinese scholars have digged into this part. I am currently working on it. The introduction of Charlotte Brontë, the translation of Jane Eyre's early reception from 1923 to 1945, because we have, nowadays when people talk about the reception, the translation of Jane Eyre is about, Wu Guangjian's Gu Nü Piaolingji and Li Jiye's Jian Ai Zizhuan. Gu Nü Piaolingji literally means the story of a roving orphan girl. So you can see Wu Guangjian used a kind of indirect translation of the title from Jane Eyre and autobiography into the story of a roving orphan girl. Whereas Li Jiye adopted a very direct translation into Jian Ai Zizhuan, which means the autobiography of Jane Eyre. These are two standard book-length translation of Jane Eyre, but long before these two standards, standard translations of Jane Eyre become available in China. In the 1920s and 30s, biographical notices with portrait excerpts of translation with Chinese annotation were also to be found in Chinese periodicals devoted to English teaching in China. And here is an illustration of the portraits of English authors, which I managed to find from Fudan University Library holdings. And what I failed to include in my paper is that you will see Charlotte Brontë is the only female author in this among these English authors, right? And it may provide a gendered critique of how people understand the Victorian novelists. Wu Guangjian, I will simply introduce Wu Guangjian's Gu Nü Piaolingji without attending to Li Jiye's other autobiography of Jane Eyre. Wu Guangjian and Gu Nü Piaolingji. Gu Nü Piaolingji is very expressive of the unsettling nature of the heroine's quest plot, because Piaoling in Chinese means to drift around without a settlement. And I think this arguably speaks to the uprootedness of Chinese people at that time, and by extension, Chinese society in the 1930s. Why I'm saying this? Because after the publication of Gu Nü Piaolingji, I managed to find two newspapers article which tell the story of how a little girl was abandoned and maltreated by maybe her cousin's stepmother. So there's a kind of, these two news reports mirroring the proto-narrative for Jane's early maltreatment at the Rees household were published under the same headline of Gu Nü Piaolingji. So I think Wu Guangjian's Gu Nü Piaolingji has a better sentimental appealing to Chinese people suffering en masse. And the geographical reach of the news reports from southeast China to northwest China And it's time span from 1939 and 1949, 2 years which I find these two newspapers published, show that the emotional appeal of Plain Jane's Tale to Chinese readers were both nationwide and long last. Reception of Jane Eyre novel. You will see that Chinese people demonstrated a very controversial reception on the study of Plain Jane's Tale. A critique in Modern Woman's of China, very surprisingly, lambasted what he saw as the paltry concerns of Jane Eyre and the shallowness of its author. He maintained the thought reflects life, and it's only natural that women who often lead a monotonous life had a mundane thought. So that is how Chinese people, especially, you know, are very conservative in traditional culture in the 1940s, considered the very reception of Jane Eyre. Why Chinese people at that time, especially particularly this critique, doesn't really like the story of Jane Eyre, because it is a story of a woman and has nothing big, nothing important, nothing broad, nothing wide to tell to the Chinese people or the Chinese social politics, you see? And he goes on to argue that a person, great or ordinary, in this Roman translation, who lives on this planet has close connections with the world, the nations, as well as the society. Just like plants bear different fruits due to different climates and soils, in the principle of autobiography. So he's finding fault with the very idea of autobiography. The author has neglected history and environment and the elements which have contributed to the story. So he, this critique called Zhang Jing, he failed to notice Charlotte Bronte's very explicit or implicit critique of the Victorian society at large. The reception of Jane Eyre in another woman's magazine or woman's journal called Zhiye Funyu, which literally means professional woman, Jane Eyre's winding path of survival was a delusion. Why it is a delusion? Because she escapes from the maltreatment of her aunt, does not get lost on a ramshackle wagon to left Lowood, take risks in placing an advertisement on the newspaper to look for a job and succeeds in doing so, and is saved by St. John Rivers on the brink of death. While Victorian readers lament the very tragic story of Jane Eyre, very tragic, you know, starving story of Jane Eyre, Chinese people thought this girl is too lucky. So it is only a delusion, nothing but the result of sheer luck, which should not be taken seriously in China. So the author goes on to argue, therefore, Jane's happiness is actually obtained through countless sheer luck and coincidences. In an unreasonable society, devoid of orders and plans, and this society refers to this Chinese society at that moment, almost the life of every individual is sustained likewise. Only in a reasonable social system can everyone be happy, their happiness inevitable. In China, there are so many orphan girls, but I'm afraid only very little of them, very few of them, if any, can be like Miss Jane Eyre, the author of the autobiography of Jane Eyre, right? So he does not really believe in the truthfulness of Jane Eyre's stories or any meaningful connotations of Jane Eyre in this context, because the story of Jane Eyre appears to be too lucky for Chinese people. And the reception of Jane Eyre as movie adaptation after the Second Sino-Japanese War from 1946 to 1949, we have 20th Century Fox film Jane Eyre, directed by Robert Stevenson, but it was actually introduced to Chinese audience in the year 1946, 1 year after the end of the Pacific War. When the film has its debut in China under the title of Jian Niang, which literally means Miss Jane, reviews of the movie hit the headlines of many Chinese newspapers. You have to understand the year 1946 as a turning point for the Chinese people in order to understand the controversial Chinese reception of the movie and the novel, as I will later show you. Because 1946 is the year when China won the war over Japan. So China was finally I would say, get rid of the Imperial Japan, because Japan was defeated in the year 1945, right? Well, acknowledging the emotional catharsis, nobody can help withholding their tears upon seeing how youth is being deprived and body is being destroyed. In the film adaptation, Shen Liang turned tears into smile because it was only film watching. At that time, people show a kind of lightheartedness when they watched Jenner, very much unlike the way in which they received Jenner the novel before the ending of the Second Sino-Japanese War. Before that war, Chinese people think Jenner's story is too lucky. After that, people do not really, you know, people can really control their tears because it is only film watching. People has a kind of detachment from the tragic story of Jenner because at that time Chinese people have already won the war. The prodigious victory led to a lightheartedness in people's appreciation of Jenner and his movie adaptation. They were no longer considered thought-provoking representations of the moral turpitude or social evils of a given society, but works of art for leisure and recreation. However, on the other end of the critical continuum, critics, unlike their peers before 1945, did not treat Jenner's autobiographical account simply at face value. For Chen Wei, the ostensibly autobiographical form of the fiction unveils an undemocratic system of Lowood institution. Chen's resentment against the Lowood, as depicted in the film, remained unchanged when he wrote another cinematic review entitled, rather oddly, Mistake, a Good Film Which Does Not Suit the Taste of Shanghai People. In this very short review, he does not really explain why he thought that Miss Jane is a relatively good movie, but does not really suit the taste of Shanghai people. But he has a very passing reference to the kind of education policy in public school for Chinese people of Shanghai Municipal Council. So he makes a kind of a rather weak association between Lowood education and also the similar enslavement education in public school for Chinese people of Shanghai Municipal Council. And this enslavement education in the public school was actually advocated by British people when they have the Shanghai International Settlement. So they open public school for the education of Chinese people, but these public schools are often run by British people. So he has a very, so it refers to the colonization or the colonial history of China, which will soon end. And a cinematic review, this is an illustration of Zhong Fanteng and George Orson Welles in a newspaper called Zhongyang Ribao, the Central Daily News. It writes two central characters of Miss Jane, Orson Welles and Zhong Fanteng. Yes, but after the Second Sino-Japanese War, it doesn't mean that Chinese people were actually living very happily in a very stable condition, because you will soon find Chinese society enmeshed in a kind of civil war between the Communist Party of China and also the Nationalist Party of China. At that time, call for social reforms and improvement of people's livelihood was to be found. Tang Zhi compared the novel with the movie adaptation, considering the novel as a social critique of Regency England, whereas the movie is but a failure because the director, Robert Stevenson, treated it as a love story. The terms Tang Zhi used in his critique of the movie adaptation, for example, many terms he used, unreasonable ethos and ethics, what he called old society, feudal life, is actually, I don't think British people would associate Victorian England, you know, with these terms. But in his imagination, at that time, when people do not have a comprehensive understanding of constitutional monarchy, of the ways in which British government functioned itself, he used these terms to criticize how Robert Stevenson's movie failed to notice these things. But these terms, I would argue, is usually and often used by Chinese intellectuals themselves to draw a clear-cut line between these people and the established ethics of the Chinese past. So he's using a kind of Chinese-styled terms to critique, to criticize the British society, you know? And with hindsight, social reforms in Victorian England were never as violent as those that had happened in modern China since the 1840s. Here comes the last critique covered in my paper. Nia Ganwu, whose pen name is Ganwu, he managed to see the implicit social critique hidden underneath the autobiographical narrative mode criticized. He criticized the novel not for its violation of established social norms or what Charlotte Bronte has called the conventionality when she wrote the preface to the public in the second edition of Jane Eyre, but for its half-hearted rebellion against them. So Ganwu argues something about, you know, Charlotte Bronte is aggressive, but she is not aggressive enough because she does not have the courage to make Jane Eyre to become the mistress of her master. So I don't like this book, declared Ganwu in the year 1946. I cannot help but dislike it, since Jane feels happy, honored, and is thus filled with gratitude once her master falls in love with her. And he specifically points to the, I would say, the episode. Just a second, I'm sorry. Yes. He says something about, although people of different classes love and marry each other, the hierarchy per se remained intact. For him, depicting those of the inferior origin as having the penchant to climbing the social ladder is but an insult to the lower class. He also questioned Jane Eyre on the issue of marriage. While noticing Jane tries to return to Rochester without being aware of the death of Bertha Mason, Ganwu accused Charlotte Bronte of not having the courage to enact an out-and-out violation of the conventionality embedded in the marriage as an institution by having her protagonist become a mistress. And very interestingly, I think Stephanie, we joked about this, because Ganwu is pilloried for having extramarital affairs himself twice. I don't think he is advocating adultery here. What his critiques makes clear is how radical and unorthodox Chinese intelligentsia could be in the age of dramatic changes happening on the socio-political and cultural fronts, you see? And here's the conclusion of my presentation. During the Cultural Revolution, the reception of Jane Eyre in China underwent a quite long period of questions due to its heavily ideological response to the dissemination of foreign literature. The introduction of the Brontes and the critical discussion over Jane Eyre as movie adaptation, however, happened long before Brontes studies in China gathered the momentum after the reform and the opening up of the country in the late 1970s. On the one hand, a systematic scrutiny of the transnational appearance of the Brontes in Shanghai-based English newspaper since the late Qing Dynasty fills a research niche, since previous scholarship maintains its focus on cross-cultural exchange. The intellectual debate over literary translation and the subsequent reception of the translation of film adaptations of Jane Eyre, on the other hand, uncovers the social milieu of China, which is inextricably tied to the political turmoil, intellectual revolution, and the military upheaval before the year 1949. And thanks for your attention. That's all for my presentation.
Thank you so much. So we have actually a good amount of time for questions. So yeah, anyone want to start us off with a question for Chen Ming? Yeah, let's walk around with this.
Okay, sure. Thank you for your presentation, John. Yes. That's really interesting, such an interesting survey of the reception of an omelet in a context I'm completely unfamiliar with, basically. But I guess my question is, I'm really fascinated by this idea of like wanting to translate modern contemporary novels that are speaking about today rather than literary classics.
Yes.
And then seeing the changing reception that sort of got more complicated and interrogative as like time went on.
Yes.
Do you see that kind of hinging upon that turn if Jane Eyre was a contemporary novel that was, you know, was too fortunate for the Chinese people at the time to switch back into a classic, and then that is actually when people look into the deeper themes to find what speaks more complexly about the contemporary life?
Yes, that is a very good question. I would say, first, obviously it is considered as a very contemporary novel. Because at that time, when the Chinese intellectuals discussing about, you know, the translation according to the kind of, you know, the urgency order, they were actually discussing more about the translation of Soviet Union literature into Chinese. And they do not turn very close look to literature by Charles Dickens, by Charlotte Bronte, Jane Austen. They are more focused about how, I think they are more focused about, even when they are translating European literature into Chinese, they are more focusing about those kind of revolutionary literature like The Gadfly, Irish literature, or those literature by what those people would call marginalized group of European nationalities, you know. Now this Jane Eyre has been considered very clearly as a classic, but I think this turn happens as you already said, as time went by, because in the 1940s, I think people become more aware of the social critique embedded in Jane Eyre's narrative. Before that, even in those journals and magazines devoted to women's education, people fail to see how Jane Eyre's story can be associated with a large social critique. I think that is the, I would say that is also closely related to how Jane Eyre has been translated into Chinese, because before these two booklands translation became available in the year 1935 and the following year, people choose to translate Jane Eyre in a very abridged form, abbreviated form, you know. Currently, I found another very interesting topic, but I simply do not have the time to delve into that, is another very famous Chinese intellectual called Zhou Shouduan. He's the representative of what we call the Yuanyang Hudie Pai. Means, I have a passing reference to this Yuanyang Hudie Pai. Yuanyang means ducks. Hudie means butterfly. So that is what we call the ducks and the butterfly school. And those school of literature, they advocated the love story between a talented man, what we call caizi in Chinese, and a beautiful woman. Talented man, beautiful woman. Talented man, beautiful woman. That is the perfect union between, at least, between Jane Eyre and what they may saw as very suitable for the figure of St. John Rivers. You see, talented man and beautiful woman. So Zhou Shouduan translated Jane Eyre in a very abbreviated forms, only four chapters, starting from the cry, the mysterious cry of Bertha Mason. Because the duck and the butterfly school also advocated Gothic literature, kind of thriller, you know, sensation story to appeal to those young women at that time. So that is why, maybe that is why Jane Eyre has been first understood as a kind of woman story without anything significant to contribute to the Chinese society at large. Yeah.
Yeah. distinguishing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions? Maybe I just quickly build on Seb's question and say, I'd love to know more about what qualified a book to be in either of these categories, because it seems to me that when Dickens, you said there were 7 Dickens novels translated,
yes.
And he also seems very reliant on what I think it was professional woman called countless sheer luck and coincidences. So there's a lot of that going around in Dickens. So it was maybe a gender problem there. And then you also mentioned that in passing that Paradise Lost would have been disqualified perhaps from being considered classic.
Mm-hmm.
Although Faust is allowed... What's the
problem,
yeah? What exactly is disqualifying Milton? So yeah, maybe say a little bit more about what those, how those categories were delineated, if at all, or was it a kind of impressionistic subjective category?
Yeah, this is a question that is very difficult to answer because I think the anonymous reviewers also have the same question, and I think Western scholars turn out to be very interested in this part, especially. When I have the kind of, you know, the scholarly conversation with them. Even when a Spanish professor of literature, he wrote my email asking about how do you define classic and ancient, because he's studying, you know, George Bernard Shaw. And I mentioned George Bernard Shaw in my work. Zhou Zuoren says something about, well, the works of George Bernard Shaw should not be translated into Chinese. Because it is too aggressive, too what he'd call subjective. I don't know if he had Jenner in his mind when he was talking about, you know, subjectivity of those literature, because obviously, as you can see from the autobiographical mode of Jenner, it is a very subjective work. It advocates individuality and subjectivity. But he says something about, you know, I'm afraid Chinese people, especially young people, will follow suit if they read those works that has a very strong subjectivity in the narrative mode. He says something about this. But that is the difficulty, I think that is the problem of the primary literature I had when I was constructing my paper, because yes, as a I have already said, they did not really define what they mean by classic or modern masteries. They only had examples. So that is how I delve into, you know, the category between ancient works for scholarly research and also those modern masteries by using the examples they have given. Maybe Faust can be considered as classic rather than very modern literature. I don't know. It's kind of a shortcut I used to categorize Jenner into the modern masteries. But what I failed to include in my paper is about how modern secretly translated to Jenner into Chinese without telling Li Jiye, because the second translator of Jenner, he's a very good friend of Maldon. And Maldon even wrote a comparative study of Wu Guangjian's translation of Jenner and Li Jiye's translation. And he has a very frequent correspondence with Li Jiye till the late 1970s, but he never mentioned that I am currently translating Jenner. I don't know why, but anyway, that is maybe the magic of first-hand material, yeah.
Yeah, no, really interesting to think about. You're talking about, you know, we want big, important, broader themes and not
yes,
too autobiographical, and then Paradise Lost is out. So it's really interesting to think about what that could be.
Yeah, he does not really exclude Paradise Lost from the public view of Chinese readers. He's only saying that Paradise Lost is something for scholarly research.
Okay.
So it is not urgently needed in Chinese society at that time.
I see.
Yeah. In terms of what you mentioned as the sheer luck of, you know, of Chinese women, they simply understood the story of Jenner to be too lucky to be taken seriously into the Chinese society, because if you delve into, you know, in a more specialist manner about how Chinese people suffered under the reign of Qing Dynasty and the late Republican China, when China was invaded by Japan, you will understand why Chinese people have felt Jane Eyre turned out to be so lucky, you know, whereas Victorian people had their tears over Jane Eyre's plain story. Yeah.
Other questions? Yeah.
That was so fascinating, and I just feel that my mind is going off so many places. I love how you look at the way that the kind of social critique of Jane Eyre gets picked up on and covered in different ways over time, and the way that her status as an orphan and that the school in particular, how that is read differently. Given the way that that critique of the school is linked to British colonial presence in China, I'm interested in how people thought about Bertha, the character of Bertha in the attic, and the kind of the colonial themes within Jane Eyre, if that changed in Chinese reception over time.
Oh, very surprisingly, because I failed to find many first-hand material relating to Bertha. I think Chinese scholars focus on the figure of Bertha more recently. I mean, not that recently, I mean in the late 80s and the 90s, after the reform and opening up. Before the reform and opening up, they refer to Bertha in a very passing note, you know. There's a mad woman. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. So the first question I cannot really answer.
Sure.
About the colonization of Shanghai or the colonial presence of British in China, I think it is, a scar for Chinese people. I mean, obviously, the British colonization has played a very important part in the modernization of cities like Hong Kong and Shanghai. But I think Chinese people have a very complicated, response to that, what maybe Korean people would call a colonial gift. I don't know, because the other day I had a kind of a little conversation with a friend from Korea. He said, Chinese people should be grateful to the fact that you are colonized by the British people, whereas we Korean are colonized by Japanese people. We are treated in a more inhumane way. So he called Hong Kong, the fact of Hong Kong, as a kind of colonial gift. Whereas people were murdered, were slaved, were raped when Japan invaded Korea. I don't know, because I mentioned in my reading of the cinematic review of Miss Jane, the movie in China, that is the only reference to the colonization of British people in China. Mm-hmm. And he's referring to the colonization in a very passing manner.
Yeah, yes. More just in relation to that,
yeah.
The school system.
I also managed to find some, the kind of graduation certificate at that time of Chinese people graduating from those public schools run by British people. But I didn't really include that in my paper because it is very vaguely and weakly related to my subject matter. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, thanks for your question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I didn't attempt to the readers in Hong Kong because there's a lack of first-hand materials. I did want to do a geographical reading. I want to have a map of China because there are so many newspapers talking about Jane Eyre. But those newspapers are run by different parties. Mm-hmm. Communist parties, the nationalist parties, some minor parties, some private institutions. I think they have very different political stance. But the difficulty with this, my idea of drawing a geographical map of China with different papers and their political stance is some of the papers are headquartered in three different places. So that is why I failed to, you know, include, you know, a kind of, you know, a Shanghai reading or a Hong Kong reading or a Chongqing reading in my paper. Yeah.
That is quite interesting if you can find a reading community.
But that is a very good suggestion. Maybe I could do some follow up about how it was received
yeah.
in Hong Kong
because
or in Taiwan.
In Australia, we have a trans community. They also read a reader translating in China and Hong Kong and, you know, transfer to Xin. So they also read a translation.
Yeah. Because Hong Kong is a very different example. I would say because at that time Hong Kong is still governed by the British rule. It is not part of China. It was handed over to China in the late 1980s. So that is how I think China merits a very special mention because it is completely different from how Chinese people can receive Jian in mainland China. I mean, yeah. So.
Any final questions for Chen Lin? Okay, then great. Let's thank our speaker. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.